I've never felt like this before. It's like you just get me. I feel like my true self with you. Does that sound crazy? And it doesn't hurt that you're gorgeous. Okay, that's it. I'm taking you home with me. I mean, you can't find shoes this good just anywhere. Find a shoe for every you from brands you love, like Birkenstock, Nike, Adidas, and more at your DSW store or DSW.com.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. The Islamic Republic of Iran, since the B-2 raid over Iran, there has been talk of talks. Now, what I've learned about Iran over the years, thanks to Benham Bentalibu, who joins me from the Foundation of the Defense of Democracies, that these are brilliant talkers. This is the land of the bazaar. My mother's people comes from the land of bazaar, I know. They engage. They'll have coffee with you. They'll say, come back the next morning. We're talking about buying a rug, but in this instance, we're talking about nuclear weapons or not. In any event, what do they have to talk about after the B-2, after the stand down, after the apparent ceasefire? Benham, a very good evening to you. Bazaar, they're good at it. So what does Iran want? And then we come to what the U.S. and its allies want. Good evening to you.
A very good evening to you, John. Always a pleasure to be back. Listen, I think you're right to tap into the bazaar mentality because there's nothing that would ever stop them from really wanting to continue talks. I mean, you just had the president of Iran come out and speak with Tucker Carlson on a podcast/interview, talk about his desire for talks. You've had the Iranian foreign ministry and foreign minister talk about it wasn't Iran that ever shut the door to diplomatic solution. And that's because up until June 12, June 13, they were operating under the assumption that so long as Trump was talking, Bibi was not shooting. But post June 12, June 13, once the bombs started to fall, both from the Israelis first and the U.S. second, I think the Iranians realized how poor their tools of contestation, terrorism, missiles, what have you, are. And their embrace, if tacitly, so as to make it themselves not look desperate, of talks, even in a post-strike scenario, is designed for them to be able to capitalize on their strongest weapon, which is the political weapon rather than the explosive or kinetic weapon. So they want to actually tap in to this duel. They want to actually get the U.S. back into the world of talking and not shooting. And so long as there is a gram of uranium on Iranian soil and there is still an iota of spirit in the supreme leader of Iran's life, I think this is going to be the play.
Your suggestion to me in that summary is that Iran was surprised by the B-2 raid. They thought the talking would continue, that Mr. Trump was engaged. Is that correct?
I believe that the regime, believed part of its own hubris when it came to the deterrent capabilities and the warfighting capabilities they had, despite the setbacks of 2024 and early 2025. But when it came to their political strategy with Trump 2.0, I think they really overread a lot of the press reporting about the Trump-Bibi rift, about the factionalism within MAGA and the traditional Republican right. And to that end, they did not take seriously the return of maximum pressure in February. President Trump's 60-day, I think, window for talks starting in late March or early April. Timeline escapes me, forgive me. And to that end, I think they thought they could, for lack of a better word, rope-a-dope the president and use the president, for lack of a better word, as a human shield against Israeli strikes. So I thought that they would, so I assume, and based on their response, you can kind of see it in the action, proof in the pudding, that they were taken aback by these strikes.
The Ayatollah, was he deceived in some fashion by Mr. Trump? I note that the Ayatollah is back. There's been a report at the FT that he appeared above ground or without security at an event. That was not true for some weeks. Is he in some fashion register that he was deceived, or is he maintaining victory?
You know, the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who is 86 and the longest serving contemporary autocrat in the Middle East, and the second supreme leader in the 46 years of Iran in modern history under the auspices of the Islamic Republic. He is a character who sees everything through a kaleidoscopic lens, but, you know, takes the facts and filters them through that ideology which always ends up redounding to the benefit of his ideology. So now that he's seen Israeli and American military prowess, now that he's seen, depending on your word and legal definition, preemptive versus preventative military action taken against Iran's nuclear program by both countries, he is seeing that as a confirmation of what he's always believed about these countries, that they're evil, not to be trusted, the great Satan, the little Satan, you know, what have it, you know, these phrases and these types of ideologies better than most, John. You've been following this for many decades. I would say, however, that that doesn't mean that he won't resort to diplomatic tools or to posturing. I mean, he has available to him what every Middle Eastern autocrat has available to him, which is the fact that he survives the battle allows him to frame that as winning the war. And every Middle Eastern leader who's lost the battle militarily still claims political victory. So I think him coming out after such a long time was designed to spin defeat as victory. But one can't say trust has been shattered if trust never really was the causal factor for his engagement to begin with.
Now we cross the line. What does the U.S. want from talks? I'm supposing that these talks are scheduled, but I don't have a date. What is to be achieved for Mr. Trump and his counselors?
Well, just so that we get the window properly, it was reported late last week, but unconfirmed by the U.S. and unconfirmed by the Iranians, particularly from Witkoff and Araghchi, the special envoy and foreign minister, that late this week there would be talks between those two individuals in Oslo for some reason. It didn't mention direct or indirect. Neither side still has confirmed that. Now, again, Axios is reporting, and the Trump administration is saying that there will be talks soon because the Iranians had, quote unquote, reached out. The Iranians have not denied that there would be talks soon, but they have what they have denied the fact that they were the ones to have reached out. I think privately and publicly, you see the Iranians trying to save face quite a lot here in a post-strike scenario, but still be interested in diplomacy. And in a world where the Iranians, even post-strike, are interested in diplomacy, the Trump administration has to have its red lines quite clear, I should say, before going in and holding them during these talks, because that's really where the bizarre mentality can water down a military victory and turn it into a political defeat. And the Middle East, as you know, John, is littered with military victories that have failed to be transformed into political victories. And I'm saying that because if the president allows the resurrection of enrichment on Iranian soil, or the president is unable to achieve IAEA access, which we can discuss later, is critical to going back to these facilities, to getting a real measure of where Iran's nuclear program is post-strike, we're going to be in a real intelligence pickle.
I want to pursue the nuclear weapon risk, but stopping here at the ballistic missile risk, does the U.S. now say clearly anywhere that not only do they want to dismantle the suspect nuclear weapons program and the supply chain, but also they want to dismantle the ballistic missile production and the warehousing and the arsenal and the threat? Is that said by the U.S.?
It has not been directly said by the U.S. Targeting the ballistic missile, both capacity and capabilities of the Islamic Republic of Iran, is a pillar or is a prong of the president's national security presidential Memorandum 2 strategy, or popularly called Max Pressure 2.0, which came about this February of 2025. And in a world where I think operating at the 500,000-foot strategic level, you have this kind of diplomatic and economic pressure against the Iranian missile program, as well as tactically and more locally, the Israeli kinetic and the sabotage against the Iranian missile program, there may be a world in which the Trump administration may feel like it doesn't need to articulate it. But I would say we, however, at FUD, when we put out our own monograph, yours truly was a co-author of this, along with Andreas Ricker and Ord Kitchery, we focused one leg of the entire monograph on the delivery vehicle for a potential WMD, which would be ballistic missiles. And, you know, in our world, if there is still a deal to be had, the way you have to do that is to get the regime to dismantle and cease production and testing of any projectile that exceeds the missile technology control regime thresholds. And those thresholds are any projectile that goes over 300 kilometers and any projectile that goes over 500 that can carry over 500 kilograms when put these two things together, range over payload. Now, this would be even very hard for the Islamic Republic to agree to on a day that didn't have a strike. And even if they did hypothetically agree to this, that doesn't mean that the short term or the short range, I should say, threat to our bases closer to the Persian Gulf or to the Iranian homeland would not be under threat. But certainly it would be a start. And if the Trump administration was going to adapt some of the counter-missile rhetoric into its counter-nuclear rhetoric, this is the easiest way you can do that under the umbrella term, quote unquote, dismantlement.
You've written extensively, and we've talked about your work on the missile program in Iran. To your satisfaction, is the Trump administration educated about the scale of it and the arsenal and the unknown sites and the ability of them to manufacture the more? Is that all information that Trump people have?
I believe with respect, it's information that they have. It's with immense respect an open question as to what they're going to be doing about it, not, you know, in a post-strike scenario, but in shaping the political space, in constraining the domestic supply chain, in preventing, for lack of a better word, the building back better of Iran's missile infrastructure. Before you can even gut it or dismantle it, you have to prevent it from coming back to begin with. And I think there's a lot that can be done creatively on the cyber side, on the covert side, on the sanction side, that when put together and applied with, you know, the potential for overt Israeli military activity, can do a lot to really squeeze this weapon. And, you know, I've been focusing on this weapon. I've been at FE 13 years. I've been focusing on this weapon for about, 11 and a half of my 13 years here, for good reason, because for almost a decade and a half, this has been the largest ballistic missile arsenal in the Middle East. When Iran reached out to directly strike the U.S. in January 2020 and in June 2025 at U.S. bases in Iraq and Qatar, respectively, it did so with ballistic missiles. When back in April and then in October and then in June of this year, the Iranians engaged directly with the Israelis, it was with ballistic missiles that they did so. This is the weapon of war, both for conventional and unconventional sources for the Islamic Republic. And any strategy, be it American, Israeli, European, that ignores this, is going to ignore it at its own risk.
Then back to the suspect nuclear weapons program. The three sites that are mentioned again and again, Fordo, Natanz, and Isfahan. The IAEA has documented those sites. It's documented other unknowns in the program over the years. But there was always the question of military sites, never revealed or never identified or never inspected. Are those still part of the conversation to worry about because of that missing enriched uranium?
You know, I have real concerns here, John, because if they were unknown unknowns, meaning if we didn't know that we didn't know where these were, and we compounded that unknown fear with the cognizance or the understanding or the realization that many of the declared sites like Arak, Fordo, Natanz were once undeclared sites, and that much of the regime's overt and now, quote unquote, permissible or above ground nuclear activity was once all covert, that raises many, many fears and creates many sources of skepticism, not just over if you have a deal, how do you know the deal can be enforced, versus if you have a conflict, as we just had, how do you know that everything that should have been hit was indeed hit? You know, if you don't know about a centrifuge production plant and you have a deal or you have a war, well, then that activities of that centrifuge production plant continue in the background absent of your deal or absent from your war. And I mentioned centrifuge production because we don't have continuity of knowledge, you know, literally the IAEA words here, since February 2021 when it comes to centrifuge production. And there's no doubt in my view that, you know, nothing can really withstand a 30,000-pound bunker buster bomb in Isfahan, Natanz, and Fordo. So, you know, if you're worried about the centrifuges being pulled out there from tomorrow, I think you should go worry about something else. But if you're talking about the stockpile, which is in canisters buried deeper, either entombed in Fordo, probably not going to be taken out soon, or removed, or God forbid, in deeper storage in a place like the tunnel complexes that approach the Isfahan facility, for example, we have a much larger problem. What I say to the people in Washington is we have a much larger problem, not because the regime will first rush to use any fissile material that it has stored and that has not been hit already by the U.S. or the Israelis to produce a bomb tomorrow. But we should fear that because of the political advantages lingering undeclared fissile material affords the Ayatollahs to bargain and build leverage at the negotiating table when they were just beat at the battlefield. And this is a tool of regime survival. The fact that if you have undeclared and loose fissile material on a territory as wide as Iran, and create an AQ-Con network for you on the scale of, you know, many, many times of what we saw with Pakistan, that ability to threaten other interests of ours gives the regime leverage, even if they can't fight conventionally against us. So that's the short-term fear I have. The medium to long-term fear I have is that there is some fears over, you know, what was struck in Isfahan, like conversion, While a lot of the stuff that was in Isfahan was industrial scale, imagine if the Islamic Republic did have undeclared labs and research centers that supported the declared labs and declared research centers, some of which were also hit by the Israelis in the early part of this campaign. And perhaps they may not be able to help with the conversion en masse, but they could do so small scale. And one wonders if inch by inch this regime will try to reconstitute. And if time and if history is any guide, they will reconstitute. Yes.
Ben Talablu of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. We've been focusing on the brain of the octopus. We're going to the arms.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
This message comes from Greenlight. Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. With Greenlight, you can send money to kids quickly, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on what your kids are spending with real-time notifications. Join millions of parents and kids building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get started risk-free at greenlight.com/iHeart.
Does Friendly have a taste? If it does, it's probably like Hello's peppermint-flavored anti-plaque and whitening toothpaste. Brush away plaque, show tartar who's boss, and remove surface stains to naturally whiten. Hello's thoughtful and flavor-forward products make brushing your teeth feel like a confetti-filled bathroom dance party. So say hello to Hello with the always cruelty-free, never tested on animals toothpaste that's made to spread smiles. Visit HelloProducts.com and let Hello add some everyday yay into your life.